Can you imagine any religious denomination that tells its members that if your children disagree with what the pastor says, you should not accept any phone calls from them? Well, yes, that's exactly what Jehovah's Witnesses are taught.
You're listening to The Critical Thought, where we challenge our listeners to use critical thinking when examining the teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Hi, this is Lady C.
Hey, this is JT.
Welcome to another episode of The Critical Thought. We have a guest with us today that we want to talk to. You may know him as XJW Fifth. We're going to be talking to Fifth about his life growing up as one of Jehovah's Witnesses and the real life video that he just released on YouTube. So Fifth, welcome to the program.
Hey, I'm honored to be here with these legends right here, JT and Lady C. Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Oh, we appreciate you being on our channel. Finally, we're collaborating on something.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been trying to do this for a while. We've been talking about trying to put something together, but everybody's schedule is as you know, hectic. But we really thank you, Fifth, for taking the time out of your schedule, man, to do this, because we think that your life experience and what you are doing with your life is something that people need to know. And we think it'll be a positive lift for people who are leaving this organization, who are trying to refocus themselves and go forward.
That's right. So now let's just talk a little bit about your name, because, you know, people that may not know you that's listening in the community for the first time, why XJW Fifth?
So Fifth is actually my suffix, which is kind of an unusual suffix. Normally you have a junior, maybe a third. So my first and last name has been continued for five generations, including mine. And my son is actually the sixth, because I decided that I wouldn't be the one to stop it. We've come such a long way, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why. So Fifth has actually been a nickname of mine since maybe like my late teens or something like that. Like even as a witness, like my close friends, they would call me Fifth. When I was at Bethel and Walk Hill, my nickname was Fifth as well. So that's really my nickname.
So Fifth, how did you become involved with the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, I became involved. It really starts with my parents. My dad, as far as I understand the story, my dad's mother started kind of studying with the Witnesses when he was about 12 or 13. And then he got baptized when he was 17. And then on my mother's side, elsewhere in another part of the country, she got baptized as a Catholic as a baby. And then by age 7, she got baptized as a witness. So somewhere, you know, within that 7-year span, clearly like her parents, you know, converted and became Jehovah's Witnesses. So by the time we got to me, you know, there were already three older sisters that were, you know, born into this family. And so I was a fourth child, and, you know, we were just, that's all we ever knew was being raised as Jehovah's Witnesses.
Could I back you up just for a second?
Sure.
How old was your mom when she got baptized?
She was 7.
Wow.
Yeah, I know that's not the most common age, but she got baptized when she was 7, and sounds like she's never had a regret.
So how long has it been since your awakening to the truth about the truth?
So it's been about 5 years now, actually. It's amazing to think that time just goes by so fast. But I was disfellowshipped in April of 2016. And I kind of say that I was partially awake when I was disfellowshipped. It's a bit of a story. But when I completely woke up, and when I say that, I'm talking about like reading Crisis of Conscience and starting to watch YouTube videos and reading what's the other book? I used to know it very well. Captives of a Concept. That was another book that I read that was very, you know, very helpful to me. So yeah, once I kind of got there and came to and kind of looked behind the veil and saw everything that was kind of going on behind the machine, that was about like June of 2016. So again, disfellowship in April 2016, completely awake by June.
Wow.
Yeah. What were some of your like cracks in your foundation?
So one thing that started to kind of bug me were the changes, you know, the so-called new light. You know, when you spend these years committing these teachings to memory, and even though they sound like a little bit crazy and they don't completely make sense to you, but you trust the slave. So, you know, even though my brain is telling me this seems a little bit odd, I'm trusting in Jehovah and the people that he has established as representatives. Right. But then 5 years later, when you say, you know what, it's not really like that. It's actually like this. I'm like, wait a minute. So what am I doing taking your word for it then? If, you know, I should just trust my own instincts, and then what do I need you for? And but I didn't allow myself to go too far down that rabbit hole, so to speak. Right. You have all of these, the organization makes you kind of police yourself and your own thoughts. So I didn't even really allow myself to go in there, but it's just kind of like anything. If you keep kind of cracking away at that foundation, even if you try to ignore it, eventually it's just going to get to a point where the dam is broken, so to speak, and you can't really keep pushing all of this stuff down, you know?
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, Fifth, as you started this journey, were you able to talk to anyone, or did you ever say anything to anyone? Because that's sometimes what people do, is they'll see these things and they want to share them with other people. Did you find yourself doing it? Or are you just like, I'm going to hold on to this until I'm sure of it? Well, how did you handle it?
Well, once I started doing the research, like I said, I was already disfellowshipped at that point. And leading up to me being disfellowshipped, I had expressed some doubts to my dad. And so he was kind of aware, and maybe a cut to a couple of other friends. But, you know, obviously, once I was already disfellowshipped, I couldn't really share it with anybody. Nobody would, you know, accept a meeting with me or speak to me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I basically, more than anything, what I did is I started my channel. I put out a video in November. So, again, everything went kind of quickly, right? Woke up completely in June. By November, I put out a video, and that was kind of my way of just telling my story and trying to be helpful to people who were looking for answers. But yeah, there wasn't really anybody that I could talk to that I was close to or had a relationship with that was a Jehovah's Witness that would, you know, that would even listen to me. I will say that there have been people since I have left and since I put out a video and everything that have come back around and said, hey, you know, I was one of those many people that was criticizing you and talking crazy about you when you left. And now I figured it out. I want to say I'm sorry for everything I said. I didn't even hear any of the things they said, you know, but they felt bad and they were acknowledging, you know, that. So I've actually had a few people come back around, but not no family members or anything like that. So that's kind of how it's been for me. So,
okay. So this first video was your activism video. What made you be interested in coming out on YouTube to tell your story?
So I had watched a lot of other people such as yourselves and, you know, a bunch of other YouTubers, well-known YouTubers, and they had helped me, you know, you guys included, just by your honesty and how genuine you came across and everything like that. So I just felt like I wanted to pay it forward. And I felt that because I had achieved certain things within the organization, my voice may actually carry some weight, you know, because I was at Bethel, I was a ministerial servant, I was in a couple of foreign languages and different things like that, and went to go, as they say, serve where the need is great. So I felt that, you know, that's something that could be valuable in this space, in this ex-Jehovah's Witness space. So I really didn't have the intention of, like, I'm going to make a channel and I'm going to be an activist. It was literally just, I'm going to make a video and share my story. And that was as far as I thought it through. And then it wasn't until the responses and all of the view, I wasn't expecting, I was literally thinking like, if 25 people watch this video, that would be great. And I was being very, you know, serious. Yeah. And then thousands, you know, and it's like, wow, I just really appreciated your story and I can relate. And it's like, wow, you realize that, you know, how many similarities there are, even if you think there's aspects of your story that are unique, and there might be, but it's still a shared experience, right? So like when you tell your story, that's why I always tell people, it doesn't matter whatever your experience was within the witnesses, somebody will be able to relate to it. So if you put it out there, you're going to help somebody who had that specific experience. So anyway, once I kind of saw that, I just made a second video, you know, and then it was like, okay, I'm gonna make another video. And then, that's just kind of how it went. One thing led to another. And, you know, I just kind of kept doing it.
Yeah, I fully agree. That's kind of the way we did it as well. And that's why we always tell everybody, every voice needs to be heard, because people hear it, they relate to it, and it's just on the money. And it's a good thing that people like yourself and ourselves and others, because if nobody did it, like with Raymond Franz, if Raymond Franz had not stepped forward, I cannot imagine how many people would not have learned the things about this organization that we did. So I think everybody in some way, some form or fashion, needs to get their story out and let others know, because it will change people's lives. And that's been the biggest take for us since we've had our channel.
Absolutely.
Right. So now, what are you into now, Fifth? What's your life like? What's going on in your life? You know, you're not doing that many activism videos right now, but you are involved in the music industry. I do know that. So what is it like now for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm mainly, you know, focused on music at the moment, and I'm just telling my story. You know, one thing that always attracted me to specifically this genre of music was that people were just talking about their experiences. You know, they were honest about their pain, about their struggles, about their triumphs and things like that. And that always appealed to me about rap music in general, even though obviously it was very taboo in the organization, especially at Bethel. But, you know, that's another story. But so yeah, that's what I've been doing. You know, I've been just telling my story and just trying to be artistic, trying to be creative. And other than that, you know, I still, you know, work as a Spanish interpreter. So it's kind of interesting wearing like both of those hats. I'm in court, you know, with a suit on, and then I'm doing this at the same time. But you know, there's no reason not to. So I'm just doing everything that I want to.
And what are your challenges in juggling the what can I call it, corporate life versus the entertainment life? What are your challenges?
Well, I think what's interesting is anytime those worlds kind of come together in a way. So like, for example, there are colleagues that I'll have that'll be like, hey, I think I saw you rapping on whatchamacallit, you know? And so that's always kind of like, oh yeah, I do that too. And it's just kind of funny. Like it's not an issue or anything. It's just kind of like, it's kind of like these two separate worlds, but because it's on Facebook, and if somebody just searches my name on Facebook, they'll see me and they'll see the music videos and all that kind of stuff. So as far as juggling it, I mean, to be honest, I've been doing the interpreting a lot longer than I've been doing the rapping. So, you know, I've been interpreting for like 12 years, you know, for a long time while I was a witness. That's what I was doing to regular Pioneer and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, interpreting now kind of comes second nature, and the music thing is, you know, it's just something that I do when I can, but it is kind of picking up some steam. So I'm happy to see that. And you never know what the future holds. There may come a day where I'm only doing music, you know, and I'm definitely open to that possibility. But as of right now, you know, I'm still doing both.
Yeah.
Right.
Let me ask you this, because I know growing up in the organization has a lot of focus on music. I mean, that is a huge thing.
Yes.
When we were at Bethel, like you were saying, both of us, we know for a fact that became a major thing at Bethel. You could actually be kicked out of Bethel because of your music.
Yeah.
It's interesting because even little witness kids, they know all the latest songs. I mean, my wife had a little sister in her car, and she was back there just singing, boy. And then she caught herself basically, oh, I'm so sorry. Sister,
right.
You know what I mean? and so as witnesses, as you look back on yourself, did you find yourself at times, because especially in the rap music, you can't, it's all about the words and the beat,
right,
pretty much. And so you can learn what the tune is and you can learn it. Did you find yourself actually falling into that as well?
Yeah. So it was one of those things where rap was really the genre that appealed to me most, just for the reasons that I mentioned before. And, you know, at some level, I felt like I was able to relate to it. So having to basically kind of deny myself of that, especially how important music is, I think, for a lot of people, you know, especially for me, it was very, you know, it was therapeutic for me even back then. Like it would, you know, I just would kind of get into it and sometimes, like if I was working out or if I was walking or whatever, it would just kind of, it would be nice. It was like a nice escape. So it was like, this genre is off limits. So I'm like fighting against myself and thinking God hates me because I'm attracted to this style of music. Something must be wrong with me, right? Because the publications basically say that if you are attracted to these things, then you must not love God. And that's kind of a heavy thing, especially for a child. I'm like, man, I'm terrible. Like, I love this music. What should I do? You know? So, but yeah,
I'm 12 years old, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it was always a struggle. It was always a struggle. And I think that's why I'm embracing it so much now. And, you know, I'm speaking how I want to speak. I'm approaching it how I want to approach it, you know, when I do the music, because it was something that really shouldn't have been off limits to me, but it was. So, but yeah, I definitely remember like what you're describing. It's like, you know, you would be in certain car groups or whatever, and a song would come on and maybe people kind of look at each other like, do you know this? But, you know, it's kind of like we can't openly say it. We're just kind of filling each other out and stuff. And the same thing happened when I was at Walk Hill. You know, a certain beat will come on because, you know, you especially back then, you signed an application saying, you know, have you listened to rap, heavy metal, or any other music inappropriate for Christians in the last year? That's an actual question, as you well know. So, you know, when you're at Bethel, it's just this weird thing because you got all these guys that, of course, they like this music, but, you know, it's just not allowed and you just can't listen to it. But sometimes like a certain beat will come on. So, you know, I know I was riding around with some guys and they would put on an instrumental of a song that I recognize. Like the words aren't there, but yeah, we all know this is AZ. Like we all know this is Biggie Smalls or whatever it is. And, you know, it was just always this kind of weird thing.
Yeah, it's always. We would go to weddings.
Yeah.
We went to a wedding once and they were playing a lot of the instrumental songs.
Yeah.
And I remember this one elder, man. He came up to me and says, GG, do you hear that? Don't that sound like? And I'm like, man, let it go, man. I'm ready for this dance. Let it go. I'm ready to go to the floor, man.
Right.
So you get that constant thing.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it kind of goes back to what you and I had discussed before.
Yes.
About how one of the challenges that really impacts Jehovah's Witness kids is how they get their dreams, their hopes, just crushed. If you have any natural talent, natural abilities, or you lean toward athletics, sports, music, arts, entertainment, it doesn't really matter what it is. If it's not for the organization, it will be shut down.
Right.
There are only two basic careers for a Jehovah's Witness youth. You either go to Bethel or you pioneer. Yep. And as we've often said, we know that they always tell us, you know, Jehovah doesn't lay off. And as you and I both know, a lot of the boys that we was with at Bethel years ago, they got kicked out because they got laid off. So we know that's not true. And it's really amazing because we discussed just recently, we know that they just had the funeral of a well-known rapper, DMX. And what a lot of people may not realize that DMX, actually him and his two sisters, they grew up as Jehovah's Witnesses just like we did. And what that means is we have a very good idea of the things he went through growing up as a Jehovah's Witness kid. In fact, I remember reading one of the quotes he had made, and it was kind of interesting the way he said it, because when I thought about it, I said, you know, that's so true, man. I mean, it's just so true.
Yeah.
DMX was actually he was actually hit by a car as a kid, and he was actually pinned underneath the car. And he got out and everything, and, you know, with the insurance companies and everything, they want to, you know, make sure they settle and get this thing out of court, out of the hands of the lawyers. And they had actually approached his mom for a settlement. And it was about $10,000. And his mom, you know, being involved with the witnesses, it affects how people think, how people reason. And she told him, she says, no, we rely on Jehovah. We don't need that money. We don't. And he said, he just completely, he's like, I was the one that was under the car. And so from that point forward, his views toward witnesses had truly changed because he realized, as he said, they were messing with my money.
Right.
And I think about how the same with so many people who are actually going to watch this video. When you take a step back and you look at your life, you can see how they mess with your money. We can see how they mess with our parents' money. Mm-hmm. Many of our parents now, they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and they don't have any money. And you think back to ourselves growing up, We had opportunities for college. I know people who had opportunity for sports scholarships. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So when you look at how Witnesses kids, some of the most talented kids you will ever see. I mean, I know just witness after witness who they graduated at the top of their class, valedictorian, and then go to college. And right. So down the road, 25 years later, they have messed with their money. And one of the conversations that you and I had was about, we look at people who are in the entertainment industry, and sometimes you kind of take them aback as who has actually been involved in this religion. I mean, it is unreal. When you hear people say, well, you know, I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness knocking on doors on Saturday, you're like, oh my goodness. Because right. You know what their life was like.
Right.
The biggest thing was they got no encouragement. We know they did not get any encouragement. I've told you many times, you know, you take the Williams sisters, you know, talented tennis players. But we all know that if it hadn't been for her father, who was not a witness, but their mom, who was, they would have never played tennis. They would have never, if he was an elder in the congregation, he would have took those tennis rackets from them. So absolutely. When you look at people now, because you're in the entertainment, which is a whole different little level of society. It is, they don't work regular hours. They have, you know, they have different schedules. When you look at the people that you have seen who have been involved in this religion, what comes to your mind when you look at them now, knowing that they didn't probably get any encouragement when they was doing this stuff?
I'm just glad that they ignored what they were told, because otherwise we would never know about them. Yeah. You know, it's definitely not any credit to the witnesses that these people come from these, you know, that these people have been raised as Jehovah's Witnesses. It's almost more so in spite of it a lot of times, right? Because yeah. because you were always told, you know, not to do it. Like even from a young age, I know, for example, with me, and I don't know how good I would have been at basketball if I had been allowed to pursue that, but I remember in elementary school, you know, they were starting tryouts for this little basketball team, and I came home. I didn't know that was a thing that we couldn't do, right? So it's kind of like as a child, you start to run into these things over and over, and you just start to realize like, oh, okay, like whatever it is that I'm probably inclined to, I probably can't do it unless I can use it directly inside the organization or at Bethel or something like that, right? So anyway, yeah, I just kind of, like I said, I'm just happy that people push through, and I'm happy that, like you said, in the example of the Williams sisters, I'm happy that sometimes there is a parent who's like, no, this child is extremely talented. We are going to develop that talent. And, you know, that's going to be the focus, you know, whereas you have the other parent that's saying, no, you know, Jehovah will provide. And what's really frustrating about this, I think, is in most of the examples that we gave, these people come from very impoverished backgrounds, right? So imagine telling somebody, a child or a family, that finally has an opportunity to perhaps make something of themselves, right? And most people who are around them in their same circumstances don't even have that opportunity, right? But there's this talent or whatever, and you're getting this religion telling you, don't take advantage of that talent. Don't take advantage of this ability. Don't take that job that's going to interfere with the meetings that could possibly get you out of this impoverished state, right? To me, that's one of the most frustrating things, because I feel like even certain communities are not targeted, but are more at a disadvantage mm-hmm. because of that, you know, because there's less opportunities available to them in general. So I just think that's something that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, we've had this conversation with a number of people over the years. Even when I was at Bethel, we had this conversation. And I can only speak from my own personal experience and what I've seen others go through as well. The African-American community is often impacted greatly. And I've had this conversation with white brothers. The difference between not only being one of Jehovah's Witnesses, but also being Black. As I tell people, if the witness don't get you, the blackness will. In terms of opportunities and things that can impact your life. And you're right. Many times when a witness kid, and most witnesses in general don't come from, you know, silver spoon in general. And so, like you mentioned, if you already are disadvantaged, the last thing you need is your religion telling you no. And we're talking about just God-given talents. This is what the child can do. Mm-hmm. And to think that they would tell you, put it on hold, wait till the new system, then you can play baseball, and then you can run track, or you can be a ballerina. We was talking about the ballerina sister when I was at Bethel. Mm-hmm. I used to see Liz all the time, this girl. And we never knew what her background was until she actually showed up in the Awake magazine, where they told her story. She was a ballerina, and she was going to play on major stages in London, New York. And then she became a witness and pioneer in at Bethel. And I don't know if her husband was in the group that got kicked out recently. So, I mean, and so these things that people put on hold, it impacts them greatly. Right. I mean, just so greatly. Yeah.
Now, Fifth, you had mentioned, I think I heard you mention something about you, when you were like 13, you were interested in rap music or? Did you want to do the rap yourself, or were you just interested in it?
So, I mean, being already a baptized Jehovah's Witness by the time I was 12 or 13, because I got baptized at 9.
Oh,
so
man.
it wasn't, I know, me and my mom, we were both tripping. Yeah. But, I mean, it was never like, I'm going to be a rapper or I want to be a rapper per se, because it's not really even a thought that I entertain. It just was one of those things that, like, I knew I liked it. And then I liked rap music. And then one day, I don't even remember the first time, but one day I made a song, and it was like, wow, like, this is pretty good. And it was just kind of like, I'm just going to make it for my own entertainment, maybe show a friend or two. Obviously the subject matter had to be very like rated G, and it was just kind of something I would like share with friends and things like that. There was an occasion where I wrote a song and my sister found what I wrote, and I was probably, I don't know, maybe 13. And she took it to my parents, right? Just snitching, basically. And so my parents called me in the room, and they have this sheet of my lyrics, on there. My mom is like bawling, like I've murdered somebody. It's like the craziest thing. Like, oh my goodness. She's like, I can't believe this. This is so terrible. And I actually felt like, wow, I've really done something bad. It's really nothing wrong with it. There was nothing wrong with it. But anyway, so yeah, I always kind of had an interest. And I kind of like, throughout my teenage years, I made like a couple of songs and stuff here and there, like little parodies and stuff like that. Obviously nothing serious. And I never really had an ambition of being a rapper. It didn't even really cross my mind, but I was always very enamored with the art form.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You do very well, because as I was telling you before, I said, I had my favorite rap artist that I listened to as well. And I could, sing some of those songs and everything like that, but I don't think I could remember all those lyrics. So, how did you, get into this art form and be able to remember and relate these different songs?
Well, I think it's because of the way that I create the song. So the way that I do it for the most part is through just repetition. So, I might have a beat, have an instrumental, and I'll be driving around, listen to it, and I'll come up with a line, and then I'll just kind of keep saying it, like, especially with what I do for work. Sometimes I'm driving for a while, so I might just kind of go over it like that. So kind of the repetition is built into my process of creation, I guess, so to speak. So that's probably how, I'm able to memorize it. So by the time I go and record it, I'm not even looking at any notes or anything. I have the whole thing in my mind because that's how I've, created it. And then, I practice, like when I'm going to do a music video or something, this might sound like a little corny, but I might be in the mirror. I might practice in the mirror and different things like that, just to, get familiar and get comfortable with what I'm going to be saying. Or if I'm going to perform, like I've performed a few times on stage and things like that. And so I'll just, I try to rehearse that. So it comes out good.
Right. How are you making your connections? Because I see people in your videos, I see you have to have a producer or something, but how are you making these connections with people that's helping you get your videos produced?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of it seems almost accidental. Well, I'll say, first of all, one of the most important people that I deal with professionally is my videographer, right? Obviously, even if you have a vision and a song, if the videographer can't really bring it home, then it doesn't have the impact that you would want, right? So a good friend of mine, this guy that I've actually known since like the fifth grade, and once I came out of the religion, we kind of, you know, became really close. For my birthday, he wanted to gift, because he knew I was kind of trying to make music and that kind of thing. And he said, you know what I'm going to get you for your birthday is I'm going to get you a music video. I'm going to find a videographer and I'm going to have somebody shoot a music video for you. So he just happened to go online on social media and found a videographer who works with some very big rappers. He just happened to respond. You know, a lot of people don't even respond to direct messages on Instagram or whatever, but he responded and he's like, yeah, let's do it. So I flew down to Southern California. We connected and he's shot all of my music videos. I told him a little bit about my story and he's seen the response, especially from that first music video that I made that was very specific about the Jehovah's Witness shunning experience. And he's just, you know, he was very amazed of this, at this whole world. He didn't even know this thing existed. Most people don't, even if they've heard of Jehovah's Witnesses. So anyway, he and I are locked in. He flew up here and shot the real life video that I just put out and things like that. So the videographer, that's how we've connected. And then producers, I've met a couple of producers that I work with. And then there's other producers just online who just kind of post their beats. And so if I see a beat online that I like, I'll just try to contact that producer. And then I'll work out, you know, we'll have to negotiate what it would take for me to own the beat, right? So it's a negotiation, that kind of thing. And then I've collaborated with a couple of other artists. My first album that's already out, I collaborated with one artist named P Black. He actually happens to be from my hometown. And then I've heard he was rapping later. So we kind of made a song together. And then I'm pursuing other collaborations similar to that. So it's kind of like once you kind of know certain people, like even through my videographer, right? He works with some big rappers. So it's like, I can possibly contact him and say, hey, what would it take to get such and such on a song or whatever, you know? So I'm just trying to use whatever resources I have and, you know, just enjoy the ride.
Yeah. The video that you released, we had a little clip that just kind of stuck out. Why was it important that you include that scene? If anyone is familiar with that scene, they would quickly recognize it. Being a part of how Jehovah's Witness children are treated when they're disfellowship and they're out of the home. Why was it important that you included that scene in that video?
Well, I think probably like a lot of people, when I first saw, now that came out in 2016, if I'm not mistaken, the original video. And that was shortly after I got disfellowship, right? So that would be like summer of 2016, because that's when the district convention or regional convention started. And at that point, I had received one text from my dad saying, hey, I miss you. I'm just, you know, I'm here just trying to figure out how to, like, you know, not have you in my life, you know. But he reached out, he sent me a text. One time I sent a text to my sister. She responded, even though it was very Jehovah, you know, centric. She responded, right? And then this video comes out and I'm like, you guys, I was pretty upset. And it's not even that I had like illusions of like, okay, I'm going to have a relationship with my family, but it was kind of like, I don't even know what word I can appropriately say, but it was just, it was infuriating, because it was kind of like, you know, before it was always kind of like, at least the phone call thing was just kind of more of a cultural thing. Like most likely, maybe you don't answer or whatever. When you put it in a video, now you're specifically telling my parents that if I'm called, now what's crazy about that, about this video to me, and this has been spoken about before, especially this is a young woman and she's calling, who knows what she's calling, anything could be happening and she's calling her parents, can you come save my life, right? That's possible, right? You don't answer the call because she's disfellowshipped. What are you, this is crazy, right? This is insane to me. So anyway, when I saw that, I was really upset. And, you know, as it got to the point of kind of making this video, one thing I had thought about, it just kind of came to me one day. One thing that I thought about is how they always say that so-called apostates misrepresent their position. You know, they exaggerate, blah, blah. So I said, okay, well, let's just do exactly what you guys did. Like, down to the color of the shirt, the color of the apron, is going to look exactly how you get. So there won't be any accusations of exaggeration or fabrication or anything. You know, I say that like half, like facetiously. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, it was kind of like, okay, we're going to actually use you guys' propaganda. So, you know, my videographer, I basically had him watch this video. I explained to him the significance of it. I said, this is probably the worst video clip that this organization has produced, at least in terms of the shunning thing in my mind. So I said, it has to be right on. So I had him watch it. He kind of studied it. And, you know, thankfully I had my friend's parents, you know, came and they played the role of the parents. That same friend that I was telling you about that reached out to that videographer, it was his parent. So he's been very instrumental in a lot of things. He's just been, you know, very, one of my biggest supporters, that just in life and of course in music as well. So his parents, you know, they're not actors or anything, but they care about me. You know, we have a relationship and, you know, they came out and did it. And I think it turned out, I'm very happy with how it turned out. I really got to give the credit to Starks, my videographer, because he really captured the idea and the angles and the expressions. He was like coaching, you know, my parents and saying, okay, you know, do this, look down at this and, you know, different things. So I'm very happy with how it came out.
That I was really surprised by that video as well. I mean, for them, especially something as public as that, this was done literally at the summer convention. And, you know, at the summer convention, you have news service. You have all of these organizations who are covering the witnesses for their summer convention. And for them to actually have this put up there in a public display like that. And when you think about how many times we have seen them go into court and they say, we don't shun our people. We don't. And for them to actually. And so what it really shows is the desperate level that the organization is at. It also shows you the disconnect. Because that's a serious disconnect. I remember when I was at Bethel, I would often hear of stories, people who worked in like writing and service, how they would have disconnects between departments. An article would come out that didn't go by service, or a service would put something out that didn't go by writing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what happened? How do we get these cross arrows? And so this is a perfect example of how I cannot imagine, you know, how can you sit there and argue in court that we don't shun? Then you have your organization put together an instructional video. Yeah. This is how you treat your kids when they get this fellowship. And so this video, what you put together, it really just literally just captured the essence of everything. It really did.
I think that the video doesn't give any gray area. So it didn't give the situation where somebody's stuck on the side of the road and they need, you know, help with something or whatever kind of emergency you could be having. Because they tell people that you can talk to your disfellowship family for business. Right. But that video clearly stated, hey, there's no gray area. There's nothing, you know? Yeah. So, and exactly. I think the only add-in was your son, right?
Exactly. And that was kind of the point, right? Like I wanted to, the video will be the same up until this point when my mother doesn't answer the phone. And then I'm going to show you how my story ends, right? Your story ends with her giving into emotional blackmail and going back to the religion. Okay, cool. Let me show you what I did. This is my story. And I took a different route. And I think, you know, a lot of other people have chosen not to be bullied into going back just so they could speak to their mom. It's just the whole thing is just, it's so crazy to me. But that's how they got it set up.
Just a quick question. When you showed this to those guys who knew very little about the witness organization, what did they think when they saw that? And you explained to them the context, because you got to explain the context. What did those guys think, man, when you explained to them, this is instruction video here now, man? I mean, what did they say?
I'd say a level of disbelief. There's no way. Or they actually assume that they've understood it in a different way than what it is. Like, it can't be saying this. That's crazy. Like, no, really. Like, that's really what they're saying. And it goes with the teachings. And if you listen to what the girl is saying in the background, she's praising her parents for being faithful and not answering the phone. Like, it's So yeah, most people when they actually see how this thing really is very surprising. It's very surprising to them. What's interesting to me, this is, I guess, going off on a little bit of a tangent. There's just a comment that I wanted to make. What's interesting to me, though, is that you'll have a lot of, I think, especially celebrities who will defend the organization, right? And they don't even want to. There have been some artists, some rappers that I know that were raised as Jehovah's Witnesses, but they didn't really experience the shunning, or even if they did, maybe they didn't experience it to the same degree or something like that. And for them, it's still kind of a sacred cow. Like, they still don't want anybody talking about the religion that they were raised in, or, you know, what they're. So it's interesting that I've gotten a little bit of animosity from people who kind of, in my opinion, they just water it down. They water down what it's really like, because they don't want to. They still kind of feel like they want to respect it to a certain degree, and they don't want to like speak out against it, and they don't like the fact that, you know, that I'm doing that. So that's kind of an interesting like aspect that I've come to notice.
Yeah.
How did you find that out? How did you find out that they felt that way? Did they talk to you? Did you hear it through the grapevine?
But both. There's both. There's been people who have, you know. And JT, you and I spoke about this as well, that it's kind of like, well, if it weren't for the organization, you know, maybe you don't like everything with the organization, but if it weren't for the organization, you may have ended up, you know, in this situation, or you may have ended up in a gang or whatever it is that they want to say that, you know, could have happened if I wasn't in an organization. So a lot of people for that reason they'll credit the organization with, you know, I guess, helping them to have like a childhood that wasn't completely out of control, right? Like, maybe they were living in an environment where they could have got involved in certain things, and being in an organization, even though they don't follow it anymore and they never got baptized, so they don't even have to deal with the shunning or whatever, they still look upon it kind of, you know, favorably. So yeah, people have either talked to me about it, or I've like heard things kind of, you know, come back, or, you know, maybe there's people that I haven't spoken with, but I just hear how they talk about the organization, and they'll say, well, you know, a lot of people misunderstand how they do things, but it's really loving and blah, blah, blah. Like, there's still, that's still in there for a lot of people.
Yeah. I noticed. And we see that even on just a regular level. When, for example, when we left the organization, the only people who contacted us and basically said, y'all need to come back, were people who were actually considered the weakest people in the congregation. They were the greatest defenders of the organization. All those guys on the body of elders who were ex-Bethelites, they knew not to even come to me with that stuff. They knew everything was true. Well, you know, the organization. But these people were just so sincere. Y'all need to come back. Y'all need to come back. And so we see that all the time. Especially people who may have grown up as a witness kid, never got baptized, which, like you said, they didn't fall under the shunning rule. So they can still go home and talk to their parents and stuff. And, you know, if mom want to go to the Kingdom Hall, that's okay. And that's understandable. And that's what kind of makes this high control group so dangerous. Because typically when you're talking to persons like that, they don't know what's behind the curtain. But then too, we keep in mind, it's a business. And right now we're in this real PC culture, cancel culture. If you say something against the wrong people, group, you could lose all. I mean, you can lose everything now. So people, many times when they're interviewed, they have learned, they have PR people who tell them, this is how you answer a question that's controversial. You just glaze over it. Oh, I love everybody. I mean, you know, I don't like everybody.
I think with our activism and as well as yours, Fifth, we're just speaking our truth, and we're just telling people what our life was like. Because we always tell people that being in Jehovah's Witness world, you know, kind of like put you in a better situation if you came from certain backgrounds and things like that. And, you know, we didn't have to deal with certain issues, right? And so we may not have gotten into trouble the other people that we saw growing up got into trouble, right? But here's the situation. We should not have been prevented from doing something as simple as going to college or pursuing our dream just because this religion wanted us to sell their books. When you found out about those people, how they felt, how did you feel? How did it make you feel?
I mean, I just recognize it, but at the end of the day, I think they just don't know what they're talking about. At the end of the day, right? And that's what's so interesting about what you said, JT. The ones who are the most critical, it's amazing. It's like when you were a Jehovah's Witness, you would leave the Kino Hall and go meet up with a girl and go spend the night at her house. Like, what are you talking about? You weren't even a real Jehovah's Witness. Like, you know, it's like, so, and I'm not even being judgmental about that, but it is a little bit ironic that you are the most vocal about me not speaking against the organization. You don't know what it's like to be a Jehovah's Witness and have to follow the rules, right? Because you didn't do it. Exactly. So, you know, for the most part, I have yet to hear somebody be critical that really, you know, was a legitimate Jehovah's Witness, like by the book, or whose parents weren't, you know, there's some people whose parents, I don't think it's very many, but there's some people whose parents don't follow the disfellowshipping thing that closely, right? So of course they're going to have a more lax view of this thing. But if you're, this is what I've told people. If your parents were the way that the organization wants them to be, you wouldn't be speaking to them at all. Like, you wouldn't have a relationship with them. Like, do you understand that? You know? So I just kind of take it for what it is. It used to kind of get me upset. Mm-hmm. Especially sometimes, and I had somebody, this is not a musician, but like a family friend kind of thing, kind of come at me just crazy. Just like, I can't believe what you're doing. How could you be, you know, all of this stuff. And again, it was the same situation where you were a fake Jehovah's Witness. So you don't even know what I'm talking about right now, you know? And it really actually did upset me, because it's kind of like, you can't just invalidate everything that I've gone through. Like, I've gone through a terrible experience with this, and I didn't just make this up. You know, this is like a real thing. We, you know, I have friends who have attempted suicide. We know people who have actually committed suicide. This is a real thing with this shunning thing. So, you know, don't try to tell me that it's not that bad. You know, it's the way that my parents are doing it is how it's supposed to be done at the end of the day. Well, you know, that's how the organization wants it to be done. So anyway, that's just, I just kind of take that on board and just kind of, now I just kind of roll my eyes and I say, you know, I'm confident in what I'm saying. I know what I'm
saying. Yeah, that's true. Because I always stress to people, if you want to know if the person is doing it right, this is the person they would put on the convention. Now, exactly. The example you just gave me, they would not put that up. When someone says, I don't know why the kids go to college, will they put them on the disc convention, the summer convention, the regional convention, the circuit assembly, special assembly day? No, Brother Johnson, they let their kids go to Harvard. I'm going to be so proud. No, they're not going to be the ones on stage.
Ever.
So if you want to know what the barometer is, whoever steps onto that platform and gives their life experience about what they're doing. Yeah, brothers, my son calls me 3 times a day. I see the phone, I just turn away. He's going to be on the assembly. Not the guy who says, I pick the phone every time they call. Well, that's not going to make it on the assembly. So if you want to know who's right, look at who's on the assembly. That is the example that the organization wants people to follow. And like you said, you personally, your parents are doing exactly what this religion has told them, and this is how they are treating me. Just like you see in this video. I mean, so, you know, people, and I understand, that's why I tell people, you know, they soften it, they water it down, but we know the real deal. That's why it's important that people know what is going on behind the curtain. For years, Jehovah's Witnesses have held this image, man. This image is bogus. I mean, absolutely. Witnesses are the happiest people in the world. You know that's not true. Right. You know that. And so we have lived this image. And like you said, it becomes very upsetting because you're thinking to yourself, I tried to live by all the rules, realized the rules were bogus, and I left. You ain't lived by none of them, and then you dogging me. I mean, how that right.
You know? Yeah, it's crazy.
So, you know,
yeah,
it's crazy.
So, Fifth, you know, in your activism, have you been able to wake up any people that, you know, that you knew in your pre, you know, that were Jehovah's Witnesses that you knew?
Yeah, there have been people who said that, when they were starting to have their doubts or whatever, and they saw like a video of mine kind of come up at some point, they felt comfortable because they knew that I was a very genuine, you know, tried to be very by the book Jehovah's Witness, right? So even though they had kind of heard about me going apostate or whatever it is they, you know, would have been saying, when they started to have that inkling that something is wrong, maybe they wouldn't have clicked on a video of somebody else, right? But they're like, okay, I do know this guy. And I remember like being in service with him. I knew what he used to talk about. Like, let me, you know, I'm at this point anyway, so I'll watch the video, right? So I've had some people like that. And then they've told me that that kind of was the impetus that kind of started their journey of, you know, continuing to research and all those kinds of things. So thankfully, you know, some of those people are out and we, you know, have a relationship again. So I'm happy about
that's
that.
Good. Excellent, man. That's yeah. Good.
Now I want to turn back to your music. I see your t-shirt. You've got a picture of Tupac. Is that Tupac?
Yeah, it is.
So is that one of your, the rap stars that you liked back in the day? Is that one of your favorites?
Yeah. Tupac is definitely one of my favorite rappers. He died in 1996. And back then, I was still a kid and I wasn't really into the music that much. But as I kind of got older and kind of went back and, you know, kind of became a bit of a historian with some of the music, I really like, he became definitely one of my favorite rappers. You know, the things that he would talk about, his versatility, he was just very human. You know, sometimes he would talk about, you know, something of building. Sometimes it wouldn't be quite that way, but it was just, you know, that's life, that we all have these different aspects to ourselves. So it's just that rawness and that authenticity and just the way that he would, the passion with which he would deliver his lyrics is something that was like very, you know, very, it just really impacted. So, Tupac is definitely one of my favorite rappers of all time.
He had full range. He would go from Dil Mama all the way to cussing somebody out. I mean, right. he had the whole range.
Exactly.
Development, the way he put his stuff together.
For sure.
It's just like we have always said, it's just, and I think you and I, we've had this conversation before about how as our dreams, and this is really what this is about. Even myself, I struggle with this. Because you never were allowed to dream. Mm-hmm. You were never allowed to dream of what you could become, what you can be. And it's difficult leaving an organization where your dreams are always crushed. I mean, just crushed. And so after a while, you really don't develop any dreams. For people who are watching this, and there's a lot of people who watch our channels and who passes on to other people, what would you say about your dreams? Because if you are a Jehovah's Witness, especially a Jehovah's Witness kid, your dreams are going to get crushed. That's if your parents are doing the Jehovah's Witness thing, you're going to get those crushed. That is an absolute fact. You will rarely find a Jehovah's Witness parent supporting their child and their dreams. Everything is going to be the new system.
Yep.
So what would you say about going after your dreams?
I would just say do it. You've put it on hold for long enough. You didn't acknowledge these gifts or these talents or these desires that you had. You know, like, for example, you know, rap is one of those things that a lot of people who start rapping, like kind of more seriously rapping, they start when they're teenagers and they start when they're 16. You know, here I am coming out of the religion in my late 20s, right? And starting, you know, just later than I would have, but, you know, all of this time that I could have been developing my craft even further and different things like that. Right. So it's like, you know, I could look at that and say, well, you know, maybe since I kind of missed my window, I'm not going to do it. I'm like, no, I'm going to go for it. Like, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And it is what it is. You know, thankfully I've had a degree of success with it. But even if I didn't, I still would be happy with it, because, you know, I'm now taking charge of my own life. And especially now that I have a son, that's the example that I want to set for him. I want to be able to look at him and say, man, whatever it is, go after it. As long as you're not hurting anybody, you know, all of those kinds of things, right? Whatever it is that you feel passionate about and you feel like you're able to do and that you want to do, then just go ahead and pursue it. So that would be my message to everybody watching is, whether it's, I know another thing is maybe college, right? People might get out of this organization, not at the typical college age, right? That you would go to right after high school. and you're like, okay, well, I missed it or whatever. Go for it. If that's what you want to do, just whatever it is, just go for it. You know, there's nothing holding you back at this point.
Do you think you would be one of those parents that, because you were held back from everything that you wanted to do, would you be one of those no strings attached and just anything goes? Or if your child comes home and is talking about doing something that might not be in their best interest, just from a practical standpoint, are you going to be one of those parents that's going to kind of direct them and give them pros and cons?
Definitely. I don't plan on just, I feel like that is part of my job as a parent, is to set some sort of guidelines, you know, to make sure that my child is not putting himself in harm's way and, you know, dangerous situations and things like that. Definitely. Even now, I mean, he's only a year and a half or so. But, you know, even now, I don't have a problem telling him no if there's something that's crazy or that he shouldn't be doing or whatever. I mean, it's hard to say because, you know, he hasn't really got to that age where that's kind of really become a thing. But I feel that that is how I am naturally. Like, you know, whatever you're into is fine, and I'll help you and everything. But yeah, I'm definitely like, there will be certain things that I will say, you can't do this because it's, you know, it's in your best interest, or it's dangerous or things like that. That feels like a normal thing that like parents are supposed to do to a certain extent, at least.
Yeah, because I've had conversations with people and their kids are just on their own. They're like, oh, I couldn't do it. They're going to do it. But I mean, I'm not saying that they should just, you know, tell them that they can't do stuff, but they need to do stuff within. It would be good to do it within reason.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what I'm going to try to do.
Because
I
think there's a big difference between guiding someone and shutting somebody down.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And like you and I, we discussed before, in the witness world, whether you wanted to be a rapper or if you wanted to play the flute in the New York City orchestra, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter.
Right.
It would have been shut down. So it don't even matter what the subject is. It would have gotten shut down. And so when you're able to see that you can help your own child, and that's really what you really want. You want your child to do better than you. That should be the natural inclination. Everybody, I want my child to always do better than I did. And that's really the natural inclination. And unfortunately, our parents, they got tripped up with this religion.
Yeah.
Because the religion said, if you do this, they'll be in the new system. They're thinking that's much better than where I'm in right now, because I'm in the hood right now. So this will be much better. And that's kind of what got them. Like you mentioned before, people will say, well, if you weren't a Jehovah's Witness, you know, you would be in the game. Like my roommate, when I was in New York, when I was in Bethel, my roommate was from Southside Chicago.
Mm.
They had to run. He said practically every day, man, he said they had to run between two or three different gangs just to get home from school. Because when you cross over certain blocks, you're in somebody's territory. And he said they would live out the run almost every day. And so he said, you know, if it hadn't been for the truth, I would have been one of those gangs. And unfortunately, in the African-American community, that is often the only options that we often look at. I have to be very religious, bless you, Jesus, thank you, God. And that's all you do. You're really into the church, or you're in the gangs. And so oftentimes in our community, we don't get that middle ground, or that middle balance ground where you can be a part of. And so that's why the witnesses clean out their bags when they come through the hood.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I remember going on field service, man. You go to the projects, you clean your bag out. You go on the other side of the town across the train tracks, man. People like paradise. Look around; you already in it. Right. And so the message resonates, and that's why when people are leaving this organization, especially African American, their family or their witness family is still in, will often say, "Well, where are you going? Look what's out there. You could be like your cousin, your nephew, your uncle." And oftentimes they're not really doing good, and they will literally have a point. But the problem is, as we often know, is that the Watchtower crushes you in other areas. I tell people all the time, witnesses are not the only people who can help people get over issues.
Exactly.
People go to Alcohol Anonymous and they stop drinking. They didn't have to become a Jehovah's Witness to stop that. So the witnesses try to sell it that they're the only ones, they're lock, stock, barrel with the only answers to people's problems. And that's just simply not true.
Yeah, absolutely. So where are you planning on taking your music? Is it you're just going to just ride this train, figure out what your next stop is? How are you going to work it out?
You know, I've kind of just been going with the flow, just you know, making music, trying not to force anything. You know, I make songs when they come to me, so to speak, right? So I don't usually like just sit down and be like, okay, I need to make a song. It needs to be about this, you know? So I'm just kind of going with it. You know, I'm taking my time. I'm trying to put out something that is quality, something that I can, you know, stand by. Also just trying to be creative and have fun with it and things like that. So I don't have any specific, you know, plans. I think what I'm working on is trying to possibly do some collaborations with some other artists. You know, that's probably one of the biggest things that I'm currently like in talks and stuff with some artists to try to, you know, to try to collaborate with them and kind of show myself to their fan bases, you know, and stuff like that by being on a song with them. So yeah, but we'll see. I'm just kind of going with it. And
that's good. But you're going to try to get into the mainstream.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, my story is what my story is. So, you know, but if you've listened to other songs of mine, most of them are not Jehovah's Witness specific, right? I mean, I think Cost of Doing Business, my first song, is pretty Jehovah's Witness specific. This last song I put out, Real Life, is probably kind of along those lines as well. Although
sprinkle a little something in there.
I sprinkle it in there. Yeah. So for the most part, I think most of my material is, you know, something that is able to be enjoyed and appreciated by the masses. But when I say certain things, ex-Jehovah's Witnesses will be like, it will have a kind of a deeper meaning for them. But I've showed these songs to other people that don't have that background. And I heard one guy, he's like, man, that reminds me of one time I had this argument with my dad. I'm like, all right, well, okay, that works. You know, so a lot of times it's just relatable. It's relatable on a human level, right? But the ex-witness will find, you know, even perhaps a deeper meaning.
Yeah. Well, you know, Phil, if I tell you, man, I'm really glad we did set aside the time today to go over your life experience, and hopefully your life experience can help someone else who may have similar things and see that, yep, if you take those lemons, you can turn them into lemonade. And we really appreciate all the background, sharing the videos and everything. And we wish you absolutely the best success in what you endeavor to do, man. We really do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate you guys, you know, having me on. Like I said, I've admired you guys. I've watched your channel before I even started making my activism videos. So have a lot of respect, tremendous amount of respect for what you guys do. You guys are helping so many people around the world. So I'm just honored to be able to sit down and have this conversation with you guys.
We're glad that you made time to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This has been Lady C.
And this has been JT.
Hey, this is Lady C. Thank you for tuning in to The Critical Thought. We appreciate having you in our audience. Not only that, but we invite you to subscribe to our channel and be sure to hit that bell so that you can receive notifications when we upload new content. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and give us a thumbs up if you like this video. Thank you for being in our audience.
This program was sponsored by Critical Thinkers.